Hello and welcome to the D20 Future Show. I am, as always, your host and your GM, Richard. We're back again, at last. As you've probably realised, I'm struggling a bit with the editing schedule right now, so once again, our Everyday Heroes campaign, The Carrington Disappearance, is on hiatus. Continuing, mostly uninterrupted, is the D20 Future Show Live, which is our fortnightly Twitch stream. We're coming to the climax of our Horde of the Dragon Queen campaign. Or Adam the DM is going to kill us all soon, one or the other, we're never quite sure. But whatever happens, you can be certain that Bumbleweed Nugglethump, halfling barbarian and owner of the Gentleman's Cheese, deserves whatever trouble Adam puts him into. However, a month ago, I went to the UK Games Expo and I had a great time. Over the next few months, you'll be hearing, hopefully, some quick on-the-spot interviews I recorded at the Expo. But UK Games Expo 2023 did give me the excuse to interview someone I've been chatting with on Twitter for ages and have wanted to get on the pod for some time, Jonathan Hicks. Jonathan is the author of a number of RPGs and adventures, as you'll hear. Sadly, his good microphone was not working, so the audio quality on this interview is not what it might be. But I've done my best to clean it up, and I hope you'll agree with me that, audio quality aside, this is well worth a listen. So here we go, my interview with Jonathan Hicks. Hello and welcome to the D20 Future Show. I am, as always, your host and your GM, Richard. And I have here with me today, and I say with me, on the other end of a Discord call, game designer Jonathan Hicks. How are you doing, Jonathan?
Good evening. I am fantastic. I hope you're well, and thank you very much for having me.
It's a delight to have you on. You are someone who I've kind of chatted to on Twitter, and you had a podcast for a bit, and so I've sort of... I've always felt like it was inevitable I would interview you at some point, but it's never quite happened, so I'm very glad to have finally pinned you down.
No, same.
So, listener, we are just in the kind of the dying embers of the afterglow of UK... I nearly said Dragon Meat there, I don't know why. The UK...
Because we were just talking about Dragon Meat.
The UK Games Expo 2023. The first question, I guess, I have is, how was your UK Games Expo?
It was really, really good.
Excellent.
I get annoyed with it every single year because I can only ever make it for the one day, the Saturday. Mm-hmm. And I get to see everything, but I don't get to soak it in properly.
Sure.
So I spend, especially nowadays, I spend a lot of my time chatting to people and moving about and networking in some respects. This, the one that's just gone, I did have a bit more time to sort of mooch around a bit more.
Okay.
And instead of focusing on what I'm going to buy, I focused on what I was going to enjoy. And it was much better. And I thought this year's show was really, really good. So, yeah, definitely looking forward to it again. I've been to every single Games Expo since it started.
Okay.
Before it even moved to the NEC. I think, wow, I've only missed one. But every year, it's always an absolute treat. How about yourself? Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I had a fantastic time. I mean, I was there for the preview on the Thursday night. For because I am press, apparently, which is that's slightly absurd, but there it is. I am press.
No, they used to give me press passes when I was running Farsight Blogger, when I was blogging a lot more, and I was writing and putting the stuff up, and I used to do reviews and interviews and stuff like that, and it was great. But it's a lot of work. I imagine you were running around trying to find people and chatting to people and recording conversations, yeah?
Yeah, the preview really helped with that because you have a lot of the people you want to speak to all kind of corded in one space.
Yeah.
It's been a while. I last Dragon Meet or so, I've kind of taken the attitude, well, everyone's got a microphone, let's just do an interview afterwards.
Yeah.
And that meant that I had a few longer interviews, which were cool, but I thought, no, I'll take the gear this time and I won't then fill up my diary afterwards. And I'll get some quick interviews with people. And then you meet new people I'd not met before, which was cool as well. The guys who publish, it's called Coffee Quest or something like that, where you have to, it's designed as a bolt-on to whatever your fantasy campaign is, but and your characters are supposed to maintain all their powers, abilities, weapons and magical items, but they have to run a coffee shop as things go badly wrong, where it turns out the ability to cast Fireball isn't that useful.
Unless you're reheating the coffee.
I think whatever it is, 20-foot radius sphere is a bit much for that.
That's a lot of coffees.
That's a lot of coffee. Listener, at some point I will drop these little interviews, but I got a lot of little interviews. I spent the Friday just kind of soaking it in.
Yeah.
Just sort of walking the floor, seeing things without... I kind of promised myself I was only going to buy one thing, which was a book of random tables from Loki Battle Mats, which I did.
Yeah.
And I nearly kept to that. Other than that, I was pretty good.
Yeah. Until,
yeah, until the odd thing cropped up. But a bunch of people gave me things, again, because I'm press.
There we go.
I will talk about those and maybe even play them at some point, which is just good.
You managed to generate more work for yourself.
That is what I did. In fact, a moment, I was stood in the bar in the Hilton and in a moment of kind of self-parody said, well, I'm press, give me free things. At which point somebody handed me a solo RPG. So I now have the solo RPG of running a radio station during a nuclear war.
That's fantastic. That sounds really good, actually.
Here we go. So some of the little treats I was given include from the delightful guys at Beyond Cataclysm, Operation Santa, which is Strategic Annihilation of Nefarious Tentacled Alien, which is designed as a Morkborg adventure where you travel to the North Pole and kill a monster and save Christmas.
Sounds like fun.
Tyrannosaur Inside, which is not a hex crawl. It's a T-Rex crawl, as you T-Rex crawl inside a Tyrannosaurus Rex full of, apparently, Tyrannosaurus Rexes. It is, I'm told, Tyrannosaurus all the way down.
That's very meta.
And the thing I was handed, jokingly saying, I'm pressed, give me three things, I was handed Blackwell Games' Dead Air, in which you try and keep a radio station going despite the fact there's a nuclear war going on.
Yeah, I've seen that cover. That looks good.
Which, I don't really know anything about solo RPGs, except that they exist. I've never
tried it. I've seen it done, and people have asked me if I was going to do anything for Those Dark Places as far as solo is concerned. And I know there's somebody on YouTube who tried it, but it's not something I've ever really approached. I've read about it, but never actually tried it. It is something that I really want to try.
Yeah, well, there's as far as I can tell, there's kind of two schools, one of which is the Oracle Tables, and you play it like the tables are your GM.
Yeah.
And then there's journaling games where what you're doing is you're writing something. And I think Dead Air I might try and turn into an audio project because rather than writing something, it's about running a radio station. I'll just be a radio DJ, except that I'll be drawing cards to find out how badly things go wrong before eventually...
And how you got to report it on the radio.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds extremely good, to be fair.
And there's kind of... They seem to fall into those two camps, one of which is you can be the hero and you can win and you can finish the quest or whatever. And the soloing RPGs is sort of, my death is coming, it's inevitable, and it will finally come. And you are just playing up until the point where you stop writing because you're dead.
Yeah.
Are they not...
That's only slightly nihilistic.
Yeah, which sort of... They all seem to be a bit sad like that. But on the other hand, I'm kind of fascinated by this one now, and I've got it, so I'm intrigued. Anyway, what were we talking about? Saturday I was more like playing games and trying not to buy things, but again, interviewing people and some of those people being lovely enough to give me stuff, so... Yeah, had a really good time.
No, it's good. It was a great show. It's really good every year, and this year it was just nice to get back into the hefty swing of it as well. And I didn't feel rushed, because usually when I go, I'm meeting people and running around and what have you. But this year, I mean, I was still talking and meeting people, but there was I had plenty of my own time to have a look around. And some of the stuff there was a lot of the stuff there from a lot of the creators, especially a lot of the independent people, is inspirational, and their ideas and how they've implemented it. It's fascinating, and it was nice to talk to them as well, and how energised they are about their own products. And then you're stunned by the big stands as well.
Yeah.
So, it was good. It was a good show. There was something there for everybody.
There was, absolutely. So, two questions, I guess. What did you buy, and what did you play?
I didn't buy anything. I actually...
That's not possible.
No, I just lied to myself. I bought a large D20, actually, because it was only £1, and that's all I had in my pocket. I spent £1, and I bought very expensive sandwiches. But other than that, no, I didn't buy a thing.
Wow.
I was actually really... Because the year before... I had to remortgage my house because of the stuff that I bought.
Okay.
So,
I'm
actually really pleased with myself this year. What I tend to do now, instead of going there and impulse buying, I'll now go around, I'll talk to people, see what I want, make a mental list, or actually make a physical note, and then look at more into it when I'm at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I say I didn't actually buy anything at the Games Expo, but since then, I've bought about four things.
Okay, right.
So it has been worth it. It is worth it. If you don't think you're getting sales on the day, don't worry about it. Chances are people like me will buy something later.
So what did you see at the show that you have subsequently bought then?
The stuff, the Everyday Heroes. I got what they call for that. That was quite good.
Yeah.
I saw, it's cheeky, Osprey Games Undaunted. So I put an order in for that.
Okay.
because my son's into that kind of miniature sort of tabletop warfare as well. So
sure.
I thought that'd be a good game for the pair of us. A Conan supplement, which I've been looking for,
yeah.
Which is sitting around here somewhere, and a roll it, and all rolled up.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Which is on its way to me. But yeah, no, it's plenty of stuff there that if I could walk in there with a limitless credit card, I would just go nuts. And that's the thing about these shows, you've really got to rein yourself in. Because you get excited about something, and then it's fine buying all this stuff, but I've got to be realistic and think, will I be using this later?
Yeah, and with that...
Now, two of the things that I've bought, I probably won't be using, I bought them to read. but the other two, for sure, I will be. So yeah, it was good. It was a good show, and it was well worth a visit. I look forward to it every single year. It's one of the highlights of my year. It's my only real big convention that I go to in the year.
Mm-hmm.
I try to get to smaller ones if I can, but I'm never that lucky. So, like I say, this year, and we were discussing this earlier, I want to do Dragon Meet, because every year I plan to go, and every year something comes up, I don't make it. UK Games Expo, yeah, I always make sure I get to that.
Yeah, Dragon Meet's a lot of fun. The kind of the big difference between Dragon Meet and UK Games Expo for me is that you kind of filter out all the stuff that isn't role-playing, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are other games there, and there's a games library of other stuff to play, but I was going to say all the role-playing game companies are there, but, you know, I don't think Paizo or Wizards are there. And
no. I mean, considering the size of it, you'd expect some sort of representation.
I think
there was a Dungeons & Dragons area at Games Expo this year.
Yeah, I mean, so at UK Games Expo, I'm pretty sure they were both there, but at Dragon Meet, I don't think they bother, but it's a bit more... It's a bit more indie focused at Dragon Meet,
yeah.
Whereas UK Games Expo is kind of is while there's lots of indie things there, it's kind of your opportunity to be mainstream.
It is, yeah. And I think that's what I'm looking forward to in Dragon Meet, is because, like you say, there's a lot of more independent creators there.
Yeah.
And as much as I enjoy and divulge in the bigger stuff,
mm-hmm.
it's the small stuff that I'm attracted to, because these little books are sometimes filled with great ideas that you can use in your own game or just play outright. So oh, yeah, I'm not, like I say, I'm not making any plans for Dragon Meet this year, because if I make plans, I won't go. I'm just going to ignore it until the day before Dragon Meet and then just get a train and hope for the best. So,
all right, sounds like a plan. Yeah, I mean, so part of the joy of the kind of a lot of the indie stuff is it's designed to be one shots, or it's designed to be kind of quick and small. So you've got a better chance of getting it to the table.
Yeah.
I've sort of promised myself, now I have The Expanse and Everyday Heroes. I'm kind of like, I've sort of got big sci-fi games now. I've got that done. I know that I will play those. In fact, I ran on the Saturday. I ran The Expanse. I ran an adventure that's available for free on the Facebook group. If you are an Expanser, then the GM group for The Expanse, I think it's called, has got a bunch of free adventures that we've written over a few one-page game jams. And I ran my game Teen Trouble, in which you kidnap a teenage boy on behalf of his parents.
Okay.
I should stress it, and
I'm glad you put that in.
We cleared it up because I was given very strict instructions by Lloyd, who ran the games on demand, that he have to be over 18. So he is 18. That's how old he is. He is an out of control, very rich student, and his parents have decided that rather than cut off his trust fund, they want to have him kidnapped and taken to a behaviour modification facility. With hilarious consequences.
Tune in next week.
It is an opportunity to play an NPC who is so deeply unlikable, and it's an absolute joy.
How did you find that? Sorry, sorry to interrupt, but you talk about playing an NPC. This has always fascinated me, so I'm going off on a tangent. I do apologise.
Not a problem.
About an NPC that is fundamentally unlikable.
Yeah.
I know in The Expanse, and in some role-playing games, it's quite theatric, and it's probably a little bit melodramatic, even pantomimish sometimes, some of the bad guys are. But when you were playing the bad guy, did you feel uncomfortable at any point with some of the things maybe he was saying or taking or trying to establish the viewpoint that this person has?
I think...
The reason why I ask is because years ago I was running a Call of Cthulhu game. It's set in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was there's some murders going on, as it happens. And I threw in a janitor who was an old dude, and he hated everybody. He hated immigrants. He just hated everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he was racist and xenophobic and what have you. It was kind of a red herring, so the players would go, oh, maybe it's him, he's a bit nasty. But it wasn't. And I remember playing it, running the character, and then all my players looking really uncomfortable, and then I'm sat there thinking, I'm just playing a character, and I feel really bad, and I've never done it like that since. I've never touched it. How did you approach it?
Well, the adventure is a little bit comedic, which helps, and I kind of establish that light tone early doors. And Brayden is kind of the victim of the adventure more than the villain, in that he is kidnapped
And then, spoiler alert, it turns out that they're not nice people, the people who you deliver him to, and then you have to rescue him. And so he's just sort of every obnoxious teenager you've ever met rolled into one. And that's there's a catharsis in being someone like that, because we've all met them. And I cannot tell you how effective describing them as wearing a baseball cap backwards is.
There we go.
That almost always just breaks people. They're like, yeah, no, we don't care. We don't care about kidnapping this kid now. He's wearing a backwards baseball cap, which is amazing, because I don't think we feel that way about people in real life. But I think when it's like villains, I don't think I've ever, and a part I think is just the tone of game I run, to make an NPC I was playing racist or you know, kind of any of the kind of nasty phobics. I sort of can't imagine, that working with the tone of my games.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think what I tend to do is make them larger than life kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So without wishing to give too much away, because although I finished the campaign over a year ago, it hasn't hit the podcast yet. The villain for our superhero adventure with our D20 Modern campaign is, he has decided that he wants to do something that is obviously insane, but very much like the Red Skull from Captain America, you know, what he's doing is insane, but he can do it. He has the ability to do this thing, and so he's single-minded about that and doesn't really see beyond that. He sees his purposes and they trump everything else. I think rather than making someone, kind of like racist, it's sort of, there's that, and there's always that thing in fantasy games where that fantasy racism that's kind of a light touch, it's sort of okay for elves to hate dwarves and vice versa.
It's kind of a trope, isn't it?
And it's one of those ones, as long as you don't think about it, is fine. And then as you start to think about it, it starts to become icky.
I think my mistake with that character in Call of Cthulhu was the fact that I really wanted him to be as unlikable as possible. Because it was supposed to be a red herring, so when they were focusing on him, or what's he up to, and the person who was actually doing the ritual murders could actually get away with it again for another night. I just decided that's not the way I'm going to play bad guys anymore. Because it's just... Because if I'm going to make players uncomfortable for any reason whatsoever, it needs to be in the context of the game. But this kind of felt kind of forced. And I don't want to run my bad guys like pantomime villains. I don't want them coming on twirling their moustaches or doffing their top hats and saying that I need your rent. But at the same time, I want to make them a bit more believable. And it always fascinates me how other people run bad guys. That's why I asked.
So, that was Saturday. I ran the Expanse, and then I played the Pacific Rim kind of introductory adventure, which was a lot of fun as well.
Yeah.
I love Pacific Rim. I unironically think that the second film is good, which I know sets me apart.
I enjoyed the second film. I'm sorry, I enjoyed
the second film's really good. It's not as good as the first one, but... Name 10 movies that are, apart from anything else.
It's still a lot of fun, though. It's like the Godzilla films at the moment. I love the Godzilla film.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but Godzilla versus Godzilla and Kong.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The big fight at the end is just like, this is what I pay the money for.
Yeah. Yes, you absolutely...
Giant robots beating the crap out of each other. That's what I'm here for.
Yes,
I don't care about the personal struggles. Just punch something in the face with a chip. You know what I mean?
Brilliant. Yeah, no. Godzilla vs. Kong is not a film that requires a lot of human drama. You want the massive gorilla to punch the massive lizard.
And a lot of the idea as well, they seem to think they start off with something small and then just keep growing. Like, how about if they fight? How about if they fight at sea? Well, how about if the neighbour's there? How about if they're fighting on the ships? How about if they're jumping from ship to ship whilst fighting? Oh, there's no need to stop there. We're running out of budget. You know, it's just absolutely brilliant. Absolutely loved it.
So we punched giant monsters in the face with our rocket-powered fists.
That's what you need.
Because it's Pacific Rim, and it was ace. We had other than a disastrous press conference, which is part of the adventure, you do a press conference in which you have to try and convince the world's press that there isn't massive danger when you kind of know there is. And I rolled a lot of ones. I rolled too many ones in that session. But we had a good time. And then Sunday was kind of winding down, and then I bought a game that I'd played in the bar of the hotel I stayed at. I didn't stay at the NEC hotel because I'm not made of money. For an okay Hilton, and Hilton hotels, if you're listening, I think your hotels are fine. And I think your Doubletree hotels are really lovely.
Yep.
And if you want to sponsor the show, I would happily stay at Hilton Hotels whenever I conference.
3 days a year, I will definitely do it.
But it was a lot of money, and so I stayed a bit further out in Solihull, where a number of other people from the con were, and was invited to join the game of a game called Trade Nation, which is just a simple little card game, in the bar, because they were like, oh, well, come and play. And so I put down my copy of Sybilla Byrne, which is an Expanse novel, which is really, really good. Listener, the Expanse is really good in basically all of its forms.
Yes, I got into it with the first two books, and then a TV show came along. I did exactly the same thing with Game of Thrones. For the first two books, the TV show came along, and then just stopped reading the books. But the books are... I've got them all. I've just not read the last few. They are fantastic. So
they're different enough that I kind of enjoy them in parallel.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I bought Trade Nation and caught a few more interviews and caught up with the UK. So the UK actual play podcasting scene, I guess. We had a little meetup on the Saturday, which was cool. And I closed my show with our panel, which was a panel game themed around Dungeons & Dragons, in which it turns out I don't know anything about Dungeons & Dragons lore. Really, really, I don't. Really, I did badly. So badly in that.
I think you'll find, actually, that nobody knows that much about Dungeons & Dragons lore unless it directly involves their characters.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they'd asked me about the plot of the Storm King's Thunder or any of the lore that surrounds that, I'd have known it because I've run that two and three quarter times, but who knows? Because this current one, we have been to the Feywild to murder a hag on behalf of the warlock's patron. We have made a chicken immortal. That was the last few sessions as they broke into the Sun Elf Palace in order to use a thing called the Life Tree to make... None of which has got anything to do with the plot of the Storm King's Thunder, which is about giants. So, who knows? We're off to a casino. That could be the necessary bit of plot joining that gets us to the next bit of the adventure. Or it could be the whole start of a whole plot where they buy a casino. They also, by the way, run a brewery in Tribal. They run the Frost-Touched Frog in Tribal. I think back somewhere hidden in there was a lovely segue into your games. So, written through lockdown, you've written a number of games. Presumably some before and some after.
Yeah.
So I guess let's start with, what was the first published game that you wrote?
First thing I wrote, this was pre-COVID, I wrote a few test games, playtest copies. Mm-hmm. I mean, Those Dark Places, I originally started writing back in 2009, 2010.
Okay.
It was a much more complicated system, which turned out to be a bit naff, so I didn't carry on with that. Mm-hmm. But the first proper thing I got published was Fighting Fantasy, and I came across Advanced Fighting Fantasy by Arian Games.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it, and I was writing an adventure for some friends to play, and I've been a massive... It was Fighting Fantasy that got me into gaming in 1983 in the first place.
Okay.
So, with Citadel of Chaos. So, I went for Fighting Fantasy, then a year later jumped into Red Box Dungeons and Dragons, and that set me off. So, it was basically Ian Livingston's and Steve Jackson's fault that I became a gamer.
Yeah, I think they owe a few of us a quid or two, and it is their fault.
Yeah, I was about to say, just a knowing nod would be fine. But, I did that, and then I started writing this adventure because I bought the book, really enjoyed it. And I went to Arian Games and said, can I write an adventure for you? This is the idea that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
And within a couple of days, I got an email back saying, yeah, sure. I went, oh, okay. Wasn't expecting that. So I wrote the adventure, which was the Floating Dungeon of Arrakis Lure. And then we couldn't find an artist. And I was a bit of an artist myself. So I said, okay, then I'll have a go at illustrating it.
Okay.
Because one of my other fantastic things when I was a kid, I was into 2000 AD and all the artists who drew for the Fighting Fantasy books.
Oh, okay.
So I did some very old, traditional black and white line art, and I said, is this good enough?
Sure.
And Arian Games went, yeah, we'll use that. Okay, this is getting a bit weird now. So I wrote it, and he published it, and it was quite successful. In fact, in the last year, Scriptarium, which is the French Fighting Fantasy role-playing, I got in touch and used the Floating Dungeon and translated it into French and published the... I think I've got it here, actually. Published a lovely book. This doesn't work on radio, but there we have it. And they published this.
Ooh,
and it's all in French, so I can't read it, sadly, because I'm a lazy... Graham Davis, Paul Mason, all these different people are also included. So to be included alongside them... Oh, it also had whole new art as well, because my art is nice, but it's not that professional.
Sure.
And then I went on to write a couple of other adventures for him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I pitched a science fiction version of Advanced Fighting Fantasy. Because originally I wanted to sort of do the Traveller stuff. And he came back and said, yeah, let's do it. I started writing Stellar Adventures. And I got most of it done, about half of it done, and then I had some personal issues which I had to deal with. And then I said to Graham, I'm not going to have a chance to get this finished. I'm going to have to back out for a little while. I'm really sorry. He was fine with that. I never really returned to it. I never got the chance to. And then Graham got in touch a few months later and said, I tell you what, I'm going to finish this and I'll publish it and I'll stick your name on the front. I went, yeah, do it. By Graham Bottom and Jonathan Hicks, a complete rule book. So all the character creation stuff up until the actual game mechanics kick in, that's pretty much me. And everything else in the left is Graham.
Cool.
So that, I mean, that gives me two things. It gives me impetus to want to write more, because that's a massive ego boost. And two, I've just written adventures and a rule book, and I've illustrated the very thing that got me into gaming in the first place. That lit a fire in me, and I thought, I need to carry on.
Sure.
And then I was writing for Brian Fitzpatrick, rest his soul, for Aliens and Asteroids, the Black Circle interludes. And then I was doing other bits and bobs. So I spent about 10, 15 years writing articles on Farsight Blogger, and I was interviewing all kinds of people, which was then getting reproduced on RPG.net. So that was great. Reviews, interviews. I was building up a bit of a name for myself. I was being sent stuff through the post all the time, which was fantastic. And then I suddenly, one day, I just decided I want to really write a rule book. And I went back to my old Those Dark Places. I thought, I can really tidy this up. I can take what I've done and make something a bit special out of it. I thought, anyway. And then that's when I spoke to a gentleman called Phil Smith at Osprey Games. He was also into sort of dark or late 70s, early 80s science fiction. We got talking, and then we had a meeting at the Games Expo, of all things. And he said, OK, let's give it a try. So I wrote the manuscript, 30,000 words, and he went, yeah, let's do it. So Those Dark Places got published. And then I did work for Gallant Knight Games, cut some articles and a couple of adventures. I did Against the Dark Master. I wrote an adventure for that called Legacy of Blood, which I was really happy with. It was more story-orientated, I think, but that's not helped the way I write my adventures anymore. And then loads of stuff for myself. Just enjoyed writing little games. I came up with the Fire Team and then Cyber Streets, and now I'm doing Deal. So, yeah, been an interesting journey. And now I've got the sequel to Those Dark Places coming out in November called Pressure, which is the same as the original game, but I've expanded the rules a lot, so it's more campaign play than it was more one-shot play, which is what Those Dark Places was written for. And I've really expanded the setting as well. So that's out in November. And thankfully, I got to keep the same artist, Nathan Anderson, who basically designed the look of Those Dark Places. And he's come back to illustrate that book as well. So yeah, it's been a rocky road, but it's been a lot of hard work.
Yes, yeah.
And I suffer a lot from anxiety. So when I do my live plays, I was doing some online gaming and stuff like that, and doing all the publicity for it as well. That bit was the struggle. That was probably harder than actually writing the book. But I'm much better about it now, as evidenced by me being on this podcast.
Excellent stuff.
Yeah, it's been great. I've absolutely loved every minute of it.
Okay.
Apart from the editing. I can't stand editing. I hate it.
Yeah, editing's no fun.
I don't like going through my own stuff and thinking, do you know what, I need to take out at least 2,500 words. And I don't want to. I've just written those. I spent half a day writing that.
I like them all. I picked them. So let's talk about Those Dark Places. It's when you say industrial science fiction role-playing, what does that mean? What do you mean by industrial science fiction?
It's basically blue-collar. My favourite film in the entire world is Alien, bar none. I mean, Alien, the design, the look, the feel, the content. I've always said it was made by artists who are at the top of their game. Directorial, design work, set builders, actors, cinematography, everything. I'm absolutely in awe of it. The model making in it is just stunning. I've got my big model Nostromo here. I keep looking at it every now and then. But it's just so beautiful. And I absolutely love the film. But more than that, I also like the idea that a lot of the science fiction that I was watching, like Star Trek and Star Wars, is what I grew up with. Dealt with big ideas, so massive wars or huge, exploring new stars and, big moralistic stories, that sort of thing. But I wanted to do something that was more like Alien or Outland or even Dark Star. I wanted to do something a little bit more grounded, so you weren't following these big people with big ideas. You were following the little people who just wanted to get by. And it's in the arse end of space, so everything's functional. And because it's based on late 70s, early 80s sci-fi, everything's analogue and clunky because it's cost-effective. And you're basically just blue-collar workers trying to get by, getting a job, trying not to die, basically, out in the depths of space. Because one of the things I like about Alien and films like The Thing is that It's about a bunch of a small group of people in the middle of nowhere having to face something that they can't even begin to comprehend, and there's no escape from it. They've got to deal with it. They can't just run out, jump in the car, and drive off. Like, oh no, it's a zombie. Okay, I'm gone. Okay, jump in the Hilux. I'm done.
Yeah.
Can't do that. And there's no help coming. The help is weeks and months away.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to deal with it there and then. And that, to me, makes for a very exciting, dynamic story. It can do. So that's what I was trying to emulate. That's what I want to do with Those Dark Places. I want to make it... It's dark and it's dreary, and it's supposed to bring out people's character. But yeah, the industrial science fiction, yeah, it's just the dark, the dirty downside of space. It's the jobs in the background behind the curtain that nobody wants to see you doing. They don't care how the spaceship's built. They just want the spaceship built. They want to see it looking great once it's finished. They don't want to see what's happening in the dockyards, and that's what the game's about.
Okay, excellent.
And then you've got to deal with things like psychos in space and possible aliens and hallucinations and things going horribly wrong. Because you're flying around in a starship with 1,000,000,000 parts in it, all built by the lowest bidder. So it's a little bit scary in many respects.
And then more recently, you have Fireteam,
yep,
which is military sci-fi, which is something close to my heart as well.
Yeah, that's I came up with that idea after watching the Starship Troopers, and the first Starship Troopers animated. Was it Starship Troopers Invasion? And they're on the ship, and it flies past the space station. They're all in armoured suits, and they're running around inside a spaceship. And I was kind of watching that, and it was just all action. And I'm thinking, that's really cool. I can make a game out of that. And I was looking through my rule books. I was looking at Shadowrun and the rule system in Shadowrun. It's a little bit the original first edition Shadowrun. Basically, you roll a bunch of D6s, and if you roll a certain number, as on each dice, a 5 or a 6, I think it is in Shadowrun, then it's a success.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's different levels of success. And I thought, how about if you just roll the dice, and if you get at least 1 5, it's a success, and you can just move on to the next shot. And that's what I did. So basically, you're playing larger-than-life heroes in the military science fiction universe,
mm-hmm.
the basics of which I've actually put into the rule book. I didn't want to focus on that. I want to focus on the action. So you get about 5 pages of rules, and then you've got about 20 pages of missions. So there's 5 big missions you can go on. So yeah, Fireteam was just my love letter to films like Starship Troopers and things like The Forever War and Hammer Slammers and that sort of thing. That kind of military science fiction, which can be brutal, but can also be a lot of fun in its own way.
Sure, yeah, and it doesn't tend to be too cynical. It tends to be adventure story with big, exciting guns, and that's kind of it's about the action. It doesn't tend to kind of ask deep moral questions.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can do if you want to. There's nothing stopping you from doing that in any game, to be honest with you.
No.
But the Fireteam's not geared towards that. It's geared towards blowing stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
The actual setting, the Interstellar Combine, which I created for it, it was basically me thinking, what if it was Star Trek, but they had really big guns? So and that's basically it. So they're a nice bunch of people, but they will blow your face off.
Yeah.
So that's the way I approached it. And then you chuck in some enemies that people instinctively, sort of from a very human perspective, are averse to, like space Nazis. And then, yeah, you just roll your characters and go and shoot lots of people. And I've used it for a couple of different things. I used it for Warhammer 40,000. We did a space hook with it, and it worked really, really well.
Oh, okay.
And I also ran a Twilight 2000 type game with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
A bit more adventurous. It was kind of a lot more like Mad Max than it was Twilight 2000. And it worked really well for that as well. And then I created Cyber Streets, which is the cyberpunk version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be like a police procedural sort of version of the game.
Oh, okay.
Cyber Streets I've put to one side for now, and I'm still focusing on Fireteam. I want to do some more with that. And they're great. We talked about The Expanse earlier. One of the greatest moments on Twitter for me was that I put out about the Fireteam and I was talking about it. And James S.A. Corey tweeted, I'm interested in this game. I went, I'm sorry, what?
That's pretty cool.
I said, look, I'm more than happy to send you a copy. And he said, don't worry about it. I've already bought one. Because I like to support independent publishers. Thank you very much. And that again, you get the ego boost. And that's what that kind of feedback is what keeps me going. If I was literally thought I was just writing stuff and chucking it out into the void,
mm-hmm.
and then moving on to the next thing, I'd just probably stop doing it at some point.
Sure.
So yeah, that was amazing. That gave me the impetus to carry on. And then I did another version of it and changed the cover and changed the interior layout to make it a bit more presentable. And a gentleman called Hodag, he's on Twitter, Hodag RPG, he's an artist.
Yeah, that's a name I recognise.
He's really good. He's like old school black and white line art. He's done loads of stuff for loads of people. And he gifted me all this art and said, look, mate, I love this stuff. Here we go. I've got this bits and bobs for you. Take it. Use it.
Wow.
Thank you very much.
Mm.
Not going to say no to that. So indeed. I'm plugging Hodag RPG.
Okay.
Hodag RPG on Twitter. The guy, his work is excellent. And he's involved in some really good projects as well. So he's well worth checking out.
And then both These Dark Places and Fireteam, there are kind of add-on adventures published on your drive-through store.
Yeah.
As much as I like making stuff up and writing my own adventures and so on, systems kind of live or die by the adventures that are out there.
Yeah.
If it's just, oh, there's one starter adventure in the book and then that's it, then it's difficult for kind of things to kick around.
Yeah, because you want the world that's in the book to feel a little bit more lived in. And if you're just given one book, and it's like being given a travel book to a city that you're never going to visit. So it looks nice, but you're never going to go there and you want to know more about it before you do. And I think that's what adventures and supplements do. It's not the rules I'm bothered about, it's the setting. And the more you expand the setting, you make it more involved, you make it more attractive to visit, then maybe not so much in Those Dark Places because you don't really want to visit there because it's a death trap. But it's, if you want to make the world appealing, and I think adventures can be windows into what the world's about, and that's what I try to do with my three.
And I think it's also really useful to know how the writer envisages an adventure going, or at least how they envisage it being written, because it can be really easy to settle into, there's a quest giver, they give you a quest, you go through a dungeon, then you have a final boss fight.
Yeah.
And that's perfect for some games, and it just doesn't work for others.
It definitely doesn't work for me. I'm more of a storyteller. I like to build stories with the help of the players.
Sure.
I always have I don't create stories, at least I try not to, or not to create situations, and then we build the story and the narrative on top of that. Those kind of games where, like you say, you get given a quest, you go to a place, you beat stuff up, kill a boss, go home with a reward, that to me is a miniatures game. As much as I enjoyed Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition, and it was a good, fun game, it was a miniatures game.
Yeah.
More geared to that kind of play.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in modern Dungeons & Dragons, it's still geared towards that. It's just that it's a bit more malleable, so you can do a lot more with it, with the new 5th edition stuff. But those kind of games, they might as well just be board games. And there was loads, and don't get me wrong, there's loads of fun to be had with those kind of games, and I do play those kind of games, and I still enjoy them. But I get much more satisfaction out of telling a good story because, and I've had this discussion before, when we're talking about the games years later, we're not talking about, oh, do you remember that time when I rolled a 15? Oh, do you remember that 2d6 came up as an 8?
Yeah.
You don't talk about that. You talk about what happened in the game on a personal level, how somebody felt, what happened, how a plot twist happened. That's the moments you remember. I don't remember any of the dice rolls that I've ever made in games unless it has been something that's changed the plot so dramatically or humorously that it's sort of burnt into my synapses. But I always remember moments of drama, moments of tension, moments of emotional highs, and that's what I'm not trying to recreate it in my adventures because it's not up to me to do that. It's up to the gaming groups to recreate that. But that's the kind of thing that I strive for in my own game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think adventure writing a lot of the time is about creating the right shape of events so that the story happens in that space.
Yeah.
And sometimes that is as simple as, I'm very guilty of this when I write adventures, is someone will probably sit the party down at the beginning and tell them, this is the thing I want you to do, and this is the reward I will pay you. Go.
Yeah.
And I know I do it, and partly because it works. It's a way of getting everybody online as to what you're trying to achieve quickly.
Absolutely.
But after that, if you can try and just sort of make space for story to happen, and then and give ways in which the system will react to that story that you do happening, I feel like my verbs have got very vague. But make it not just going, well, here's a sequence of events, but sometimes here that's what the space that the story happens is. There are a sequence of events. These will happen, but this is how the world reacts or might react to what you do.
Yeah.
And then you give space for the players to be creative, whether that's solving problems or how they respond or how their characters respond to NPCs and so on.
Yeah. No, I agree. And you were saying earlier about how, maybe we're guilty, and I'm guilty of it as well, of saying, this is what you need to do, go off and do it, please, and I'll see you in 20 minutes and I'll give you a tenner. And that is a good hook. And I learnt, especially in the last couple of adventures that I started writing, I've got to learn to trust the gaming groups more. They're going to bring their own dynamics to the game. So I can't predict what a gaming group's going to do. And that way lies railroading. So all I can do is present, like I was saying earlier, like a situation for them to game in.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to get to a point where I need to trust that the individual gaming groups are going to have their own dynamic, their own way of doing things, and they're going to bring that to the table. And they're going to create their own little moments and sort of moments of melodrama and what have you. And build their own story. So I'm thinking back to when I wrote Legacy of Blood for Against the Dark Master. I had an idea of a sequence of events, a little bit of drama, a little bit of dungeon crawling, you know, a little bit of a fight. And then I wrote it, and it got released and illustrated. It was very nice. It did quite well. But then the more I looked at it, the more I'm thinking it's a little bit rigid. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of leeway. I'm telling people this is what's going to happen next. I shouldn't really be doing that. I should be creating, like, I keep going back to the same word, I should be creating a situation saying, okay, this is what's happening. You deal with it. You know, the GM makes his own interpretation of that. But I don't know. It's just difficult to pin it down to one thing because it honestly depends on what kind of game you're writing for.
Sure.
Dungeons & Dragons is a dungeon crawl. You're going to be stuck in walking through corridors or going through the Underdark or going through a closed tower. Not a lot of room for exploration and messing about, you know. The great thing about early gaming, especially D&D, is that because they were stuck in this dungeon, it was easier to control the action mm-hmm. and the direction that they were going and manage expectations a little bit more. I think role-playing's gone a long way since then, and I've kind of lost the focus of the point I was trying to make, to be fair. This is where my anxiety kicks in, because I'm talking and my mind's actually thinking about four sentences ahead. Because I'm thinking about four sentences and now I can't remember what it was or what I was trying to get to. Yeah. So I do apologise. I'm not very good at these interview things.
No, not at all, not at all. But that very much brings us back to the kind of this idea that certainly the way, one of the reasons why I like to get hold of adventures is to see how other people structure them.
Yeah.
Not because I'm going to copy them necessarily,
yeah.
But...
you can be inspired by them. Yeah, there's plenty you can take. Like, plenty of them. I've come across adventures with fantastic ideas. Like, I like the way that Free League write the alien adventure, mm-hmm. where they do the setup, they do events, yep. and then they do three acts. This is what's going to happen. They don't tell you what's going to happen or how it's going to happen. I tell you this is the three acts and this is the sequence of events. How your players react to that and what they do completely up to them.
Sure.
And I like that. It's a good approach to writing adventures because it leaves a lot of input from the game, from not only the Games Master but also the group. So that's a good way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to have a climax of an adventure in mind,
yeah.
and then it's kind of trying to make sure that whatever the players do, they'll find their way to that.
Yeah, yeah.
For kind of, yeah, for those tight adventures as opposed to campaign play where it's more sort of, I don't quite play in a sandbox, but there's room and you know where the story beats are, but if the players go somewhere else, that's fine. You find something else to... Ultimately, there is a climax. There's a kind of third act that you want. And in a campaign, maybe that third act is not a third of the adventure. But, you know, there's a kind of final confrontation that hopefully you've established the stakes for as you go along. But then when it happens, that's the main thing.
I suppose it depends on how rigid you're making the story, because if you're literally saying this is going to end in a tower in these mountains at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon whilst he's having his tea, then that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What I used to do, especially in my old Warhammer games, is that I'd have a bad guy and there would probably be a fight at some point, a confrontation, but I would never decide where it was going to be. It could be at any point, and then if I decided this is, you know, they've done what they need to do, now's the time for a fight. It could be in his tower at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the mountains. It could be down the shops, it could be down the pub, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter, they're going to have this confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to base the events around what the characters are doing. Because as a player, I like to think that what I'm doing as a character, as a player character, is having an influence on what's happening in the world. That's why you play the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not there to follow the beats.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of adventures written in a different way and so on, your latest game, mm-hmm. Deal, is a social combat role-playing game. So we're talking less guns and hiding in corridors and jumping over boxes and more. What does a Deal adventure look like?
First of all, the reason why I went for a social combat game is because I was looking for the biggest dichotomy I could find, and that was... no violence in a cyberpunk game.
Okay.
Because every cyberpunk game I've ever played in, every game I own, including the new cyberpunk, which is very good, by the way. Got my first edition Shadowrun, I've got Cyber Generations here, I've played Cyberpunk 2077. You know what I mean? It's all based around being called and violence, which is no bad thing for entertainment purposes. But I was playing a game recently, and I've just started playing it again, called Cloudpunk from Ironlands on PC. And you are basically in a cyberpunk city. It's all shady corporations. It's all a bit weird and lots of really weird tech. And your job is to fly around in a hover car and basically do deliveries. And it's a story and there's no violence. You don't shoot a gun. You don't punch anyone in the face. Flying around, you're talking to people, you're making decisions to do stuff. And it is just wonderful. And it was so nice to be able to play a game in that kind of setting
mm-hmm.
without worrying about where I was going to get my reloads from or getting myself jacked up so I could kick somebody into orbit. it was just so nice not to even think about that and constantly focus on the story. So that's when I came up with Deal, and it's a new system which I'm using 2D10 roll high. And I've kept, again, with all my systems, because I like my systems, game systems and mechanics to be simple now. The older I get, the less bothered I can be with mechanics and learning new stuff. So I kept it nice and simple. I did some stylized art, similar to what I did for Cyber Streets. And yeah, basically you're playing characters called dealers. And because it's a future city, and because it became so violent, a la Cyberpunk 2077 and all the other ones, because it got so violent, they did what they thought was best, and they literally just banned guns across the board. No guns. Mm-hmm. It was guns that are a problem. It was guns that are killing people. Just banned guns. There's still violence. There'll always be violence. You can't get rid of that. But they took away the tools that was making it easy for people to kill people. And then they did very hefty penalties for any kind of violence. So you punch somebody, you're in prison for 10 years. You shoot somebody, you own a gun, you're in prison for life. You kill someone with a gun, you're executed. So they made violence extremely harsh. So all the corporations and businesses and government, what have you, instead of wars of guns and violence and intrigue and that sort of thing, they now hire dealers. And dealers act as independent go-betweens and negotiators. So the actual game mechanics are you investigating and learning about the case between two factions, could be anybody at all, and then talking to each side and trying to come together into either an amicable solution or deciding in favour of one side. There's still violence. There's still problems behind the scenes. There's still intrigue. You don't have to play it that way. It's completely up to you. But I really wanted to focus on something that was a bit more character-driven. Now, the book itself is extremely simple. It's full of tables and there's very simple rules that gives you the basics. So what I'm doing is I released the original book so that you could get an idea of the style that I was going for. It's only 13 pages long. And then what I'm going to do, I'm going to add to that. So over time, I've actually just done several thousand words this week. I'm going to add to that book. But instead of releasing it as supplements, I'm just going to update the book. So if you've already bought the book, you're going to get all the updates for free. I'm going to build the world, build the extra rules, how it works, things you can do there. Get some feedback from people. And then once I get it to a size and style that people are happy with, and then I'll put it to print. So yeah, it's a collaborative storytelling role-playing game based on chatting and not lapping. There we go. That's the sales pitch.
that sounds like a pretty good elevator pitch there. Excellent. Brilliant. So, as we probably, given that we both probably have things to do on a Friday evening that isn't chats to, to somebody. Well, I mean, I at some point I'm going to need some food. If our listeners are interested in any of the kind of things you've been talking about, where can they find them?
I'm on DriveThruRPG. Mm-hmm. Just type in Farsight Games. Big yellow letters, but you can't miss it. And I'm on Twitter, mainly, under John Mark Hicks. That's JonMarkHicks. If you also type in Somebody Wake Up Hicks, you should be able to find me. Yeah, a lot of the time, I do a lot of my discourse on Twitter, so I just chat away. And I just come up with random stuff. A lot of the time, I'm just chucking stuff out into the ether, what people think about it, and then see if it's an idea worth pursuing. But yeah, I'll just chat random stuff. It's not always about game.
Okay, and if you want to get hold of Those Dark Places, the place to go is Osprey Publishing, where it is available electronically. Out of print at the minute. Are we ever likely to see another?
Don't know if they're doing a second edition. I think they're going to just go straight to pressure now. But I think it's still available from bookshops and places like Amazon and stuff like that as a hard copy.
Okay.
It's actually officially sold out as far as Osprey is concerned, so, which is nice.
Nice, yeah, absolutely. And when can we expect Pressure, without wishing to put any pressure on you?
Hey. Pressure is out in November.
Okay.
I think it's out in November, UK, and then the month after, was it the month before in the US? It's definitely around about November time. We'll know more in a few weeks. The layout's now finished, and I've seen the layout with the artwork by Nathan Anderson, and I am very, very happy with it.
Excellent stuff.
So that will be out. We should start seeing the first copies in September, October time, which is when I'm going to start harping on about it, like I haven't been already.
Okay.
And then that's out in November. And then hopefully I'm also working on a large campaign for it called The Desolate Stars, which is going to be compatible with Pressure and with the original Those Dark Places game. So, but I don't know. that's a work in progress at the moment.
All right, exciting stuff. Well, hopefully we will have you back on somewhere around November time to talk about pressure. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for your time, Jonathan, for reminiscing about UK Games Expo.
Thank you very much for having me on and letting me ramble about absolute nonsense.
An absolute delight. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thanks once again, Jonathan, for your time. Links to Those Dark Places on Osprey Games' website, Jonathan's first DM's Guild adventure, Fawnt's Tower, and all of the Farsight Games drive-through content will be available in the show notes, behind, beside, below, or wherever the audio is app-dependent. Show notes may go up as well as down. Always read the label. We hope to have another episode for you soon, but, well, you know, either way. I'll catch you next time on the next episode of the D20 Future Show.